Thank you, Cassie, and thanks everyone for showing up. Excuse me. Who doesn't like a good spot of salt? You're going to see a few today. This is some data that we're doing on pedogenesis and spotted salts. It's funded through a carbon project. This is soil water we've captured in these soils, and it's not some weak tea, but I guess in a way it is weak tea. We think in Michigan we've got some of the best spotted salts in the country. I guess there might be some good ones in other states. West Virginia comes to mind, maybe Maine. But, as they say in the movies, show me the goods. And that's what I'm going to do right here. So these are some of our good ones, and you'll see a few more as we move along. So we believe the best way to understand this process is to monitor it, especially in areas where the spotted soil morphologies are really strong. In other words, what is it that makes a good spotted soil? Let's figure that out. First thing we did was map the spotted soils. As you know, I'm trained in geography. I am a geographer. So this is the Sergo data. We colored the typic spotted soils brown, the Entix yellow, and the Aquix blue. And you can see there's a clear spotted soil province that exists in the northern Great Lakes region. Minnesota has very few spotted soils, actually. So we focused our work in this spotted soil province for quite some time. We wanted to know the strength of podzolization across this region, so we threw 5,000 random points across this spotted soil province, found that 1,438 of them actually fell within a Sergo mapping unit that was mapped as a spotted soil. Then, using the POD index, which is a numerical index of spotted soil development, we crigged the POD data, and this is the map we came up with. So this is essentially a map of spotted soil strength or development across this region. These are the snow belts, and snow belts will be important to us in a minute. Well, the first thing you notice is that in the snow belts of the Western Upper Peninsula, the soils, the spotted soils are actually fairly weakly developed because they're mainly forming in sandy loam and silt loam materials, which don't generally lend themselves towards strong podzolization. But if you look at the Eastern Upper Peninsula, that's your bullseye for strong spotted development, where we have a snow belt and we have very sandy parent materials. And so that's where we focused our work. The snow belt theory that we've published a few papers on goes like this, by way of a little background here. In a snow belt, thick snow will accumulate early, and that will generally inhibit soil frost. This snowpack tends to be very reliable, keeping the soil warmer, the litter warmer, than areas further inland, which at this point early in the winter might not have a snowpack. So the soils in the snow belts remain unfrozen and permeable. We have seen this many, many times. They simply don't freeze. Those deep snowpacks also insulate the litter and the O-horizon, facilitating its breakdown throughout the winter period. You can dig into these snowpacks and find out that the bottoms of them are yellow. They say don't eat the yellow snow, but as you see, you can drink it. I'll show you in a minute. So then in spring, when that large snowpack melts, you get a big pulse of water through the soil, dragging those organic acids in, chelating iron and aluminum and other elements, and translocating them down, leading to thicker E-horizons and better developed spotted soils. It's a fairly simple model, and part of our work here is to see if we can verify this with process measurements in the field. So we dug 18 backhoe trenches. Here you see them all. It's like a family photo, so to speak. Some of them were very well developed, some of them were weaker. As you can see, a mean POD index of 4.5. That's a 4.5. Mean E-horizon thickness of 10 centimeters are not that strong, but as you can see, there's some strong ones in there. We installed zero-tension lysimeters below the O-horizon, the E, and the B, the lower B. We also installed volumetric soil water monitoring equipment and temperature sensors. Here are some pictures of the zero-tension lysimeters installed, as you can see, below the O-horizon, the E horizon, and the B horizon. This is either a pin or a pointer. I guess it's a pointer. There's the one below the O, below the E, and below the B. This is what they look like. They're essentially funnels filled with acid-washed silica sand that drain into a tube. The tubes then all drain into this bucket at the bottom of the trench where there are 3-gallon jars that collect the leachate. And from those jars, tubes come up to the surface, and we can then suck the water out of the tubes whenever we choose to. We collected leachate, or we're continuing to do this after every major rainfall or melt event, and we've analyzed these by volume as well as content of various metals and carbon. Here you see us sampling the soil water in the winter. This is a portable electric drill that attaches to a pump, and because a hand pump would simply take too long, we simply let that drill run and suck those bottles dry. And there you see our attentive grad student, Mike, working and removing the soil water from those buried bottles. And there you go. That's one sampling event's worth of soil water. So we've got the water, and we freeze all this and keep it on tap, so if you want to contact us about doing anything with it, we'd be happy to talk to you. There you see the water collected from the O-horizon typically has more organic acids, and as you get deeper in the profile, those organic acids have been captured in the mineral soil. This is really good stuff to drink as well. We've found that when you drink it, you get really strong, and you love soils even more. Seriously, this is really good stuff. I've given this water to friends and not telling them what it is, and they said, this is the best water I've ever tasted. So again, we sell this to fund the research. We also measured snowpack depths and snow water content. There's Mike out there taking some snow tube measurements, and we collect those to see how much snow is on the surface. We then we accumulated these data for 2 full years, 2 full winters, 2 full summers, and used those data to calibrate a hydrologic model that comes from Hubbard Brook to National Weather Service data for the nearest site. Here's, again, I'm just going to go through this quickly. You've seen these kind of data before already. The gray is the modeled soil water content, and the black is what we actually measured in the field. And you can see that we're a little bit off in the upper horizon, but at depth we're pretty close. I won't bore you with the statistics, but they're pretty good. Here is the flux of water. The model also outputs soil water flux. Of course, we get flux data from the bottles of water. We calculate the volume that comes through these horizons. Again, these numbers aren't too bad for something as messy as a soil. And then we also model snow water content. The dots are actual measured snow water contents, and the two lines are snow pack thicknesses or snow water contents as modeled by Hubbard Brook. Not too bad. Because it didn't work, because it works pretty well for Newberry, we then input data for a climosequence of sites from the core of the snow belt to sites to the south for about, as you can see there, about 40 some years. Newberry is the site with the strong spodosols where we're getting the original data from in the field. Gaylord has strong spodosols, a little bit weaker. Houghton Lake and then Mount Pleasant is completely out of the spodosol province. So we have what essentially here a climosequence of decreasing strength of podzolization. Keep these names in mind: Newberry, Gaylord, Houghton Lake, and Mount Pleasant. So here we go. What does it mean? This is snow water equivalent. In other words, how much snow is on the ground? And you can see, again, from strong to weak here, Newberry the strongest site, Mount Pleasant the weakest. We get thicker snowpacks at these strong these sites where their spodic development is strong, much thicker, as you can see, almost double. And the snowpack lasts longer, 189 days at Newberry, 204 days to average at Gaylord. Compare that to much shorter periods of snowpack at these more southern sites. That's not unexpected, of course. But look at how much faster the snow actually melts, how quickly we bleed this pack into the soil. It goes into the soil faster, and there's more going in at the sites to the north. That's what we expected. Here's volumetric soil water content. I'll walk you through this, showing again at 10 centimeters, which is interesting, but we're really concerned with 100 centimeters because if we want to build a big spodosol, we've got to push water very, very deeply into the soil. So we have this spring wet-up period. We could come into a spring fairly dry and fairly uniform across the four sites. Then we have a wet-up period as the snowpack starts to melt. Again, notice Newberry, which is the best developed site, or the soil, the site with the best developed soils, wets up the most. Then there is a summer dry down. Notice again, all sites kind of dry down about the same. Summer, in the summer period, soils stay dry. Obviously, there are some precip events going on in the summer that reach the upper profile, but very, very few, if any, reach the lower profile. So summer is a dry period. There isn't much deep percolation going on here in the summer. In the fall, there is a wet-up period. And again, notice that the better-developed soils wet up earlier and wet up a bit more. So those soils in the north get wetter in the fall. They're all dry in the summer, but the ones in the north where the soils are better developed wet up earlier in the fall. This is the flux data. This is the key data for us. And again, notice this is the amount of water moving deep, deep into the soils. Much, much more water moving into those soils in the north where the spodosols are better developed. This is a very, very... we like this data. This is exactly what we'd hope to see. In the northern sites, the flux is not only larger, but it's also more temporally compressed. That snowpack melts over a much shorter period of time. In the fall, again, you can see the sites in the north in the fall do get wetter, and we think what we're doing there is moving some of that organic, those organic acids into the upper profile, but it's only in the spring when we can push it then farther down into the lower profile. So in conclusion, this is what, I just want to remind everyone, this is what Minneapolis will look like next November 15th, if you're interested in a field trip there. We use National Weather Service data for a number of years to put into this hydrologic model from Hubbard Brook to estimate soil water content and fluxes along this climal sequence. We found that soils are generally dry in the summer, and most wetting fronts in the summer never make it to the lower profile. So in summer, summer conditions are not a differentiating factor for these soils. They all have the same summer experience, okay? They wet up more slowly in the fall at the northern sites. The northern sites are slightly wetter, so there's a little bit of differentiation along this climate sequence for the fall season. Okay, in the north, the soils get a little bit wetter. Then in the south, the real differentiation occurs during snowmelt when we can push almost two-thirds of the total annual flux of water into these soils in about 15% of the days in the year. So these soils get all their water pushed through them in a very short period of time. And we do this best where the snowpacks are thickest in the north. And, of course, this snowmelt flushes all these chelated metals to the lower profile, giving us these beautiful white e-horizons and these beautiful brown and tongued spotted horizons. And that's why podzolization is best expressed at snowbelt sites on the sandy materials. I'll acknowledge our funding and our postdoc and be happy to take questions. Sure, there's a vegetation gradient. What I didn't mention is we have half of our sites are in hardwoods and half of our sites are in conifers. So we found that the sites behave, with few exceptions, about the same. So yeah, the southern sites would have been under mostly hardwoods, the northern sites would have been under more conifers. But we're finding that at the Newberry study area, There isn't much difference between what's going on in the conifers versus the hardwoods. Good question. That's the obvious question, right? Alfred?
Benny, so we have to imagine after last winter, of course, but the temperatures are rising in the world. So how is that going to affect your plants,
right.
Your soil development in this?
When the temperature rises, we get less snow. And one of the things we're doing in this study is we have, what you saw were data for our control sites. We have sites where we're removing the snow, simulating a warmer climate. So when after it snows, we go up and we shovel it off. And we capture the water there too, and we'll monitor all these things there too. And then we have sites where we're shoveling snow back on. So we're doubling the thickness. And you know, just in case the climate gets colder. it's a multifaceted project and a great question. We're trying to answer what's going to happen to carbon movement in these soils when we get a lot less snow, which is what we anticipate. I don't want to cut into my other speaker's time. One more.
So your snow water equipment, are you also looking at that in terms of thickness? I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah. We've found snow water equivalent is just, you know, how much water is in the pack. We're also measuring thickness, but we don't use that very much. Generally, if you've got 4 to 5 inches of snow, that soil is not going to freeze because you also have an inch or two of litter. So that's about the critical thickness is 4 or 5 inches of snow pack, and you're good. That snowpack won't, that'll insulate the soil. Thank you again.